Promenade across the floor, sashay right on out the door, and into the glade, and everybody promenade.
You're tuned to the Square Dance Radio Network. Today is Wednesday, September 14th, 2011.
And you're listening to the Do-Si-Do Show, episode number 16.
Hi, I'm your host, Dale Hodge from Columbia, Maryland.
Hi, Dale, and I'm Barb Jarvis from Wheeling, Illinois. Hello, Square Dance community. Today, we are proud to present a Square Dance caller and record producer from Texas. Many of you know of his records or songs if you don't know him, and I bet many of you know him. It's Wade Driver.
Looking forward to this interview.
Yes, me too.
And this past weekend, Barb, what'd you do?
I had a very fun Square Dance weekend in the Chicago area. We had Ben Rubright in, and we had about three squares and a lot of good dancing.
Excellent.
How about you, Dale?
Well, last week we had the rain, go away, and don't come back for a long time. Yeah, it was the most bizarre thing. You look at the weather map, and it's a straight line that goes straight over your house, and that's what I kept seeing. And it would be this torrential downpour, and then a drizzle, and then a torrential downpour, and a drizzle, and it was just
enough already.
Interestingly, though, by Friday night, it cleared enough that Kathy and I were able to go to a Nationals game, and while it rained on the way there and rained after we got home, it did not rain at all as we watched the Washington Nationals win in 11 innings. So it was very fun. And then Sunday night, I went and called one of the most fun groups that I call for as a DVD plus group in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, called Unconventional Squares. And it's just fun. You can literally call anything from any position at full speed, and they just do it, and they really enjoy it, and the people are very nice, very friendly, very fun.
I was going to ask what the unconventional part is, but maybe that's because they can dance all positions and very fast.
Yep, and if you go out and look at their badge on the internet, you'll see that even their badges are unconventional.
Do they not go to conventions? Is that what that means?
That must be exactly what that means. Who would you like to say hello to, Barb?
No one specifically, just a shout out to all the first responders, firefighters, police, paramedics. I saw a very moving tribute to 9/11, 9/11, and it just made me really feel. And some of those firefighters are having health issues now. So shout out to friends and family of anybody who served or was lost or is currently suffering. Just says something for our country to remember.
Mm-hmm.
How about you? Do you have something on a lighter note, somebody you want to say hi to?
Well, we are going to be interviewing Wade Driver, and he has a square dance business, square dance venture. So I think the square dancers and the others that support the businesses in the square dance community, whether it's badge makers or dress makers or square dancers, this weekend we have two friends, one of whom details cars, and they're square dancers, and we've known them for years. And finally we said, hey, what are you doing this weekend? And he came over and detailed both of our cars at a very reasonable rate. And even last night we got in the car, and just the smell of clean, the smell of clean is just wonderful. Excellent.
We need to support each other, and that's a good way to do it, support their business.
So we're going to be interviewing Wade Driver here in just a minute. Do you know Wade, or have you danced to Wade before?
Dale, I danced to Wade one square dance weekend a long, long time ago. It was probably in the early 80s. It was a mainstream plus weekend with round dancing. It was at a resort just outside of Chicago. I think it was at Pheasant Run, to be honest. I really don't remember. Whatever this place was, they used to have weekends all the time, and you could just pick the caller you wanted to go to. And I have never met a guy who enjoyed singing great music more than Wade Driver. I had a lot of fun at that weekend.
Hmm.
How about you? Do you know Wade?
I danced to Wade once many, many years ago
Same as
at a national convention.
Okay.
I believe he had the Rhythm Records booth there, and he was calling, and he was calling four-part harmony with a number of other top-level singers.
Nice.
And, yes, it was one of those things that it was like a siren call. The people from the halls that were walking or from the hallways that were walking by were just, like, sucked into the room to listen to it. It was just absolutely beautiful.
I know a few non-callers who bought records, and a lot of them are waits, too, I think. But you were calling at the time, right? Did you buy every record that he had there that day?
I did not buy every record he had. I did. I do have... As I used to say when they were something physical and vinyl, most of my records are Rhythm Records.
Same true in my household.
Yeah. All right, so let's go ahead and get Wade on the line. Good morning, Wade. This is Dale Hodge and Barb Jarvis from the Square Dance Radio Network.
Well, hi. I'm doing great. Glad to talk to you guys this morning.
Howdy.
How are you, Barb?
I'm fine, thank you.
Well, good.
Thank you very much for getting up so early with us to be on the air.
6:30 is my time of day, so this okay with me.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about yourself to get started here? Where are you originally from?
Well, let me give you a little background. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, originally. Born and raised, and I left there. I went to school at Annapolis, started in 1957, graduated in 61, and went to the Navy. I was a pilot in the Navy, early Vietnam days. I got out in 66, went to work, working to get a real job for a living, and married. I started having babies, and moved back to Atlanta in 69, I guess. And at that time, I went back. I'd already gone to Georgia Tech for 1 year of prep school before going to Annapolis. So I went back to Tech, got my master's degree in audio engineering, only because it was the quickest. I really didn't at that time didn't have any intention of having a record company or recording or anything else. It was just the quickest, and I wanted the MS. So, you know, sometimes luck plays helps you out a bit. But anyway, my father was a doctor, and he called Square Dances for a hobby, and I had already started my first single back in 1957 when he was calling.
Wow.
And so in 69, I told him that I really would like to learn how to call for real and not just sing calls, which I've been doing off and on when I'd go home to visit and things like that. So he started teaching me in 69, and 71, I got my first club, and that's when we started.
Wow. Great.
Long time ago. It's kind of like Star Wars, far away and long ago.
You mentioned family. Can you tell us a little bit about your family?
Yes. My first wife and I were divorced. We're still very good friends, and she's remarried and been remarried for several years. But we had three children, and of which they're, are they ever grown? They're 45 and 43 and 40. As of right now, and one lives in New York, one lives in San Francisco, and my daughter lives here. And I remarried, was remarried for about 21 years, and lost my wife to a stroke back in 05. And made the statement then, that's it, I'm done, but never, you should never say things like that, because it comes back and kicks you in the backside. So I remarried in 07, and very happily married to a young lady that I've known, oh, gosh, since 1990, I guess, from Västerås, Sweden, and couldn't be happier.
And you mentioned grandkids. How many grandkids do you have?
I have four altogether. My oldest has one, and my stepson from my second wife, Carla, he has three. He's currently stationed in Germany. He's a helicopter pilot for the Army.
Great.
How did you get started with your square dancing itself? Was it at a very young age? Was your dad calling, or were you involved with kid groups?
Well, you know, no. I came home for my first Christmas leave from Annapolis, and my dad, I was an only child, so when I left to go off to school, it left kind of a vacuum at home, and my mom and dad got involved in square dancing, and by the time, oh gosh, I left to go, of course, early in the summer, for a brief summer, and by the time I came home in December, he had already had gone through classes and would become calling, was calling for three clubs there locally in Atlanta. Because at that time, there was only about 15 to 20 figures, so it was not a great. But y'all forgive me, my wife just came home. She's a nurse, and the dog is going crazy. So I apologize for that. Anyway, when I came home in December of 57, my instruction was I got in the school with my mom and three couples and learned how to dance. That's what did that. So, and it was, I guess that was on a Friday. And the next night we went to a different club, and my dad was calling, and he finished the tip. And I said, you know, I can do that. He said, no, you can't. I said, sure, I can. I had a little rock and roll band at school. And so I picked up one of those old 78s, and I put it on the turntable and grabbed a cue sheet. And I meant it was an old Finzi Jones tune called I Feel That Old Age Creeping On. And it was on a 78 RPM record, and I got done with it. And my father said, you know, you can't do that. I said, I can't do what? He said, you're supposed to call that record. I said, what do you call it? He said, Sing-Doll. I said, what is it? I sang. That's what you're supposed to do. And we battled over that till the day that, I guess, over our approach to Sing-Dolls. Anyway, that was my first time. And so when I would come home on leave or from the service and things like that, I would get in with my mom and dance, and I'd do singing calls with my dad and things like this. And then when we actually moved back to Atlanta, then my wife went to beginner lessons, and I went through with him. That's the first time I'd actually gone to beginner lessons when I went through with her.
It's about time.
It takes about 12 years of time to learn.
And one of the things you mentioned was a number of different colleges you went to, you went to Annapolis. And you said Georgia Tech. What jobs did you have prior to square dancing?
Well, after I got out of the Navy, I started off in retailing. I worked for Macy's as a buyer for a while. And while doing that, I discovered that the guys on the other side of the desk were under much less stress than I was. So I went into the sales industry side, which I was, I guess, much more. My personality was geared much more to that side than the other, and it allowed me the more human contact, this type of thing, and the ability to use my mouth to try to sell with. And I enjoyed that, and was working for an organization in Atlanta, and I got transferred to Florida. And then from Florida, I got hired away and was out here in Houston, and that's when I decided to go full-time calling. But I was basically in what they call intangible sales. It's sold money. It was lease underwriting at the time. And so it was a good business, but it really wasn't something you get passionate about. And calling square dances and being on stage and this type of thing, for me, I became very passionate about that because it's something I just really enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm. But besides the square dance calling and the record company and the involvement in caller schools, other than square dance calling, do you have any other jobs? I think I heard about one that you might be working
on. Yeah, I'm a realtor. You know, back in, when we moved here from Arizona, because I worked in Arizona at the retirement park for 18 years, calling dances there. And when we moved back to Houston, my intent was to retire. I was 65. It was time to hang it up. And that's maybe the most boring 3 months I've ever had in my whole life, you know. And I said, you know, after you play the first 72 holes of the golf, what's left, you know? So then my wife went to work, and I became bored and lonesome.
Oh.
So that didn't work. So one of our hobbies or one of the things we enjoyed doing was going around looking at new homes or homes for sale just to get ideas about our own and things like that. I've always enjoyed that. So I did some research and went online, and I went to school, took my exam, and got my real estate license. And, you know, it's a fun job. It's, oh, I say 95%, it's always a happy job. People are happy to be going to a new location, or they're happy coming into a new location. So it's a fun thing. So I'm not going to bust my chops 40 hours a week doing it, but I normally have 1 to 2 clients all the time. When I sell those, I'll go find somebody else. But it's a fun business. I enjoy it.
Great. Now, you were talking about dancing. Do all of your kids dance, and do all your grandkids dance?
Well, no, no, and no. Yeah, my oldest went to classes, oh gosh, when he was 12, but then he discovered he was a drummer that put the end of that. My next boy was quarterback football team. He was never involved. And my daughter, my baby just went through beginner lessons a year and a half ago. She lives near here. And she went through classes and she dances on a good year once a year. You know, from their perspective, I went to the office. That's what I did. And so, you know, it was just a job as far as they were concerned. And, it paid for the toys and the education.
So starting out, you mentioned that your dad was calling. Did you have other mentors as you progressed on? I imagine you learned a lot from him, but did you have other mentors early on in your calling career?
I did. You know, and like I said, I worked with my father. My dad was probably one of the best hatch callers I've ever known. And he had a my father had two ways of doing things, perfect and wrong. He did not understand anything in between. So from a perspective learning of the delivery and hash calling, I could not have had a better mentor. From a singing call perspective or from an entertainment perspective, I went through a 4-day caller school with Dick Jones from Chalapan, New Jersey, who passed away several years ago. But Dick probably Dick and his wife Artie instilled in me an approach to square dance calling and from the entertainment side that was just invaluable, because he said, you know, you're a caller, but you're an entertainer, and there are certain things you must do to be successful. And so I got a great deal of what I am today from him.
Sounds like you got the best of both worlds there, both sides.
I was very fortunate. I did. I had two excellent mentors. Dick from the entertainment field was just incredible. And my father, like I said, I remember my very first festival I did way back in 74. And I got done, and I really thought I'd done a good job. And he had three legal pages of mistakes I'd
made. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so, you know, you just never know.
Now, before we get into current day, do you remember your very first paying gig?
My very first paying, I do, as a matter of fact. But because my dad always told me, he said, when you do your first dance, I want you to do it a long way away because you're going to be so bad, I don't want you to be around here. You know, so I drove from Atlanta to Norfolk, Virginia in July.
Oh, my goodness.
Of 71. For $25, it was 540 miles each way. I drove up there. I got there. Somebody had forgotten to open the hall up. It was just hotter than blue blazes inside. And at that time, my dad had me write everything on cue cards. And, cause he didn't sight call. He didn't do modules or things like that. So everything was either memory or written down. So I got up there. Well, my father was an all position caller, but it wasn't fashionable. And so I got there to call the dance, and those folks could do nothing past our man left that I had written on my cards.
Oh, no.
And it was a very, very long night. and I when I came home, because my wife says, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. I said, but it seems to me that from a geometric geometry point of view, if I end up with the head couple here and the number four couple there, the other half has to be the same. So I call today what we call today chicken cluckers. That's basically what I called all night long. And they loved it, and I loved it, and everybody was happy campers. And I got home and told my dad. He said, yeah, he said, that's this new approach called sight calling. It'll never catch on. You know? But my father had a photographic memory, so he didn't really care. I don't want to work that hard. So sight calling saved my career.
There you go. And coming back to this time of your calling career, how much are you calling these days? Do you still do that again?
I try to call not nearly what it used to be, but I teach beginners on Mondays, 6 months of the year. We're starting tonight, it's our first night. And then Tuesday night I have a club called Rhythm Squares. We dance, it's a plus club. We dance first, third, and fifth. High Energy Plus, second and fourth Tuesdays are DVD Plus. And then I have a club that I call for one Friday a month, which is more than adequate. And I probably do oh, I don't know, 25 or 30 guest calls around here, and maybe 8 or 10 festivals around the country. You know, I mean, I'm calling as much as I wish to.
That's the best way to do it.
That's a great, great, great position to be in.
Yes, yes. And so I'm tickled to death. I have no problem at all. I'm calling as much as I want to, and I don't think really more than I want to, so I'm all right.
You're
excellent.
Right there, yeah.
And one of the things I know that you also do is you run a couple of caller schools or involved with caller schools. Can you tell us a little bit about your involvement with that?
I do 3 a year. I do one in the state of Washington in March that I do by myself, and I do one in the end of July, 1st of August, in Birmingham, Alabama with Ken Ritucci, and then I do one in Palm Springs, California, in November with Mike Sporsky. And it's I'm using a kind of a different approach. Of course, we all follow the caller lab dictates and the caller lab curriculum as far as what is correct versus incorrect, and is, you know, in the technical aspect of calling. But I started something 1, 2, 3 years ago when in my school I do in March. We're doing a whole 4 to 5 day school on presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And my reason with that, and I'm really passionate about this, is that I'm going to the National Convention and the different places where they have multiple callers performing. And I noticed that a lot of the guys they're getting to the corner accurately. They just sound like the devil getting there. you know, and I'm thinking, how can anybody work this hard to be accurate and sound so bad? So I've started zeroing in on some of the presentation aspects, everything from cadence to delivery to singing the melody, just lots of things. And I'm really enjoying that. I think we're making some progress. And at least the guys that are going through the school seem to think so. So I'm enjoying this. One of the most fun things I've done in a lot of years.
When is that again?
I do one in March, one in, and even when I work with someone else, like Ken Ritucci, and I just did one in Alabama, which we're going to do every year. He handles all of the choreographical side, the sight calling side, the patter calling, the cadences, and I handle the presentation on how you need to sound in getting there. And it makes a pretty good combination of approach.
And I understand you're involved in Caller Lab, as all the callers seem to be. How long has it been since you joined that group? And have you been?
I was very fortunate. I joined in 1975. They had their charter membership meeting in 1974, and I was very, very honored and fortunate. I got 2 invitations, one from Frank Lane and one from Marshall Flippo, to join in 1975, and I've been a member ever since. I was on the Board of Governors for about 17 years. During that period of time.
Wow.
Was on the executive committee for about 6 years. And then I backed off for a while because I had health issues toward the end of the 90s, the first part of the 2000. But I'm back full blow and call that again. As a matter of fact, was just reelected to the Board of Governors starting this next meeting.
Oh, great.
You mentioned executive committee and Board of Governors. Are there other committees that you're involved with?
Right now, I'm the vice chairman of it's called Music Ethics Committee, and it has to do with, music piracy is as good as anything else, and sharing of files. You know, when we had records, you either had the record or you didn't have the record. That's all there is to it. But today, with everyone using computers and MP3 players, et cetera, we use the MP3 files, and it's not something you can hold in your hand.
Yep.
And we've gone through several years where the guy says, oh, you like this? Here, take this. Well, that's not fair to the people that record and produce that music. And to give you an example, record sales from 1985 to today. In 85, you cut a record you would expect if it's good. You would expect to sell it from 3,000 to 10,000 copies.
Mm-hmm.
Today, if you sell 100, you've got a really good song.
Wow.
Now, you and I both know with as many thousands of callers as out there, you've got a whole lot more than 100 calling that song.
Yep.
And the question is, how did they get it? So we're trying to, through an educational process, educate guys and teach them, this is wrong, this is theft.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is a process, because I don't think you've got more than 0.1% of the guys that are doing it on purpose. They just aren't aware this is not the right thing to do. This is not correct. So anyway, I'm on that committee. My chairman is Paul Bristow from London, and we're working on that committee. The other one, which we're really happy with, is I am chairman of the, it was called the Record Producers Committee for the last 35 years. We've changed the name to the Music Producers Committee because very few people are doing vinyl anymore, so we don't have records. But our job is got lots of heads, really. The first thing is it's called the Music Producers Clearinghouse, where about 32 to 33 active producers around the world right now. And so when they go in and record a tune, they immediately notify me. I put it on the clearinghouse list, and that song is protected for 1 year. Nobody else, ethically, can produce and release that tune, because we went through a period of time where if a pop tune came out, six labels would record the same song.
Yes.
And so, therefore, everybody got hurt. So far, I'm very proud to say in 2 years, we've had zero duplications. That's not true. We've had three, but in that case, the guy who did it second agreed to back it off and put it on the shelf and hold it for over a year.
Yeah.
So it's really working well. I'm very, very proud of that. The other thing we did, obviously, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but we did the first International Square Dance Music Awards Festival banquet this past April in Las Vegas at the Carlisle Convention, or just before the convention.
Those were the Aussies, is that correct?
Those were the Aussies, yes, sir. We presented the Aussies, and we had 20. It was our first go. We probably did a lot of things wrong, but we did lots of things right. And we were very pleased. We had great attendance. We had over 35,000 votes worldwide for the different categories. So very pleased with that. We're going to do it again on the Saturday night prior to the Carlisle Convention in Charlotte in 2013. And we'll try to correct the mistakes we made the first time and be a little better communication worldwide and this type of thing. But we're hoping to have over 100,000 votes.
Great.
So, Wade, let's step back a little bit in time and talk about how Rhythm Records got started and when did it get started and what prompted you to start it.
Well, you know, that's what you're talking about. That's my real child there. I'm very proud of that. But in 1974, I moved to Houston, and I was recording for Norman Murbach, who owned a conglomerate's a better word. He owned the Blue Star Group. He had Blue Star, Bogan, Lore. I think he had, like, a label for every occasion, just about. But Blue Star was the primary label. Matter of fact, Marshall Flippo at that time was recording on Blue Star. And I recorded on Bogan for him. And in 1975, made the decision to go full-time calling. And so one of the things, a record label to record is nothing really more than, well, it's an ego boost, but aside from that, it's primarily an advertising tool. And back then, if you were going to be a full-time caller and traveling, you needed to be recording for somebody. And I had issues with Norman over the music because his music was good. It was very, very adequate. And I'm not really big on adequate. Right? And at that time, we only had, in my opinion, one really good label that was Wagon Wheel, and it was in the process of going under. And Don Franklin was going to quit. And so when I talked to Mr. Murbach about the music, he said, we need to be using guitars and fiddles and banjos and steel guitars. And I said, this is the kind of music that's really coming on strong today. And he said, I hate that, it ain't going to happen. So we had philosophical differences in that field. And I remember he said, when he finally, the height of our discussion, he said, if you don't like the music, go make your own. I said, okay, I will. Now, of course, I had no idea if I had any talent in that direction at all. I mean, I had my master's degree, but understand that from 1969 to today, there is absolutely nothing relative in that field to what I learned.
Uh-huh.
I learned to write with chalk. Today they're using computers. So it's a whole new ballgame. Anyway, so I had already quit work, so money was a little tight. I had two of my children were born with heart defects, so I had two open heart surgeries left to look at. And so it was kind of trying to scratch it together. So I got together a little bit of money, and I went to the studio, and I said, I want to cut four tunes. And he said, I said, I got $500. He said, what are you doing for that? I said, no, I want that to include the musicians, the studio, the tape. That's got to be the whole shooting match. That's all I got. He said, well, so anyway, they were very nice, and he did. We got lucky. We cut four tunes, and three of them went gold. So over 10,000. So it went on from that point. And then we had my first recording artist with us was Pat Barber. And then we brought Bob Beyer in, and Bobby and Pat and I did it for a few years, and we added Jerry Story and Kip Garvey, and that was the original group, the Rhythm Records group. And they've split it out since, because Pat went and started his own label, and Jerry went with Tony and started his own label, and Kip went and started his own label. Everybody, you know, but everybody would do their own thing. This is the problem in this business. When you hook up with people who are natural leaders and strong people, they all want to be in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody kind of went off and did their own thing. It's just, I'm happy for them. But anyway, that's where it started.
And where did the name Rhythm Records come from?
That came from Dick Jones. Way back when I went to that school in 71, they did a critique. And actually, it came from Artie Jones, Dick's widow. When we got done, and they did the critiques at the end, thing like this, and she put a little parenthesis thing. She was talking about my sense of rhythm and the way I called and sang, and she put in quotation marks, Mr. Rhythm. That is, that's kind of the name she nicknamed me, and it kind of stuck. And then when I went to Florida, I moved to Florida in 72, I started a teen club, and they created my first band badge, which was a big, like a quarter note, and they put up down the staff of that, Mr. Rhythm, so it kind of stuck. So when I started the label over here, we were sitting here trying to figure a good name, and I thought, you know, Rhythm Records is kind of cool, nobody does that, and we were sitting at a Denny's, and if you've ever seen the logo on Sweet and Low, it basically is a Rhythm Records logo, but it's curly. I just took that wavy logo and straightened it out and put Rhythm over and ended up working them. And that's what that, because art, being artistic is not one of my strong points. So I just copied the Sweet and Low thing.
That is a great story.
We won't tell anybody.
Oh, I don't care. Listen, that's not real piracy. I can steal that.
Yeah.
I did change the, they have a natural sign. I changed that to the sharp sign because
wanted
to have sharp music. So
perfect.
I changed that.
Perfect.
How do you pick the songs that you want to use on your records? Or excuse me.
You know, I should have. I made notes on this cheat sheet you sent me here, and the word I put on here is carefully. I have to be honest, and I'm not picking on anybody because I've made as many mistakes or more than most. But as I listen to songs that other labels put out, I listen, the music on almost all of them is good, but the song selection is what makes the difference whether the song's going to be a hit or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care how good a song is on the radio, it does not necessarily translate into a successful square dance single.
Mm-hmm.
And what you try to do is have the, at least a large percentage of what you do turn out to be successful. So I listen to it. First of all, it's a long process. We could talk 4 hours about that.
Huh.
But basically, it's gotta meter properly. We have a basic rule that's not inviolate, but almost. If you slow the song down, you're gonna kill it. That's the main thing. If it's a real upbeat, you know, fast tune, and you slow it down, it's hard to say those words slowly.
Yeah.
So you have to be very careful about that. Now, you can speed one up. Again, you have the same issues. If you speed up, that's great, unless it has lots of words. And then you can't, for example, Ben Temple did a tune called Rhinestone Cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a caller very angry 40 years ago, 30 years ago, whatever, because I wouldn't record it for him. He said, why? I said, because it's going to sound like Donald Duck. Like a Rhinestone Cowboy. I said, I'm not going to say those words that fast. It just doesn't sound right.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then somebody else cut it, and I was right. I love it. You know, but I, on the other side of the coin, I recorded Rockin' the Rosalie's Boat. It was so awful, I burnt the tape. And I called Jerry Haig, and I said, this is really a pile of mess. I said, if you want to record it, go ahead. Well, I blew that one.
That was
like crazy, you know. So,
yeah.
You know, 50-50 is about as good as you can hope for.
Hmm. Now,
well, like we just did, we just got three tunes out coming out. I cannot believe that Elvis's Suspicious Minds has never been cut for a square dance.
Really?
Yeah, we just recorded it, and I am just so pleased with it. I got a call from Tony O yesterday. He said, "You got that tape ready?" I said, "Well, yeah, I don't have the vocal. I don't care about the vocal. I don't want that music." So it really came out good. I'm very pleased with it. So, you know, just search around. You try to find things. The problem we're finding today is that new music, the things that are popular today, is like a long piece of spaghetti. They're not neither. They start singing, and they sing one verse until the song's over and they quit. Mm-hmm. I hate it. It's terrible. The songwriters today are really, I don't know if they're weak, if they run out of words, or if they're just lazy. But it's tough to find good songs today. We did one, Lady Antebellum's I Need You Now. Really came out nicely, but that's the exception, not the rule.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just mentioned speeding up and slowing down. Is there a certain number of beats per minute that you're aiming for?
There is, and it's slowed down considerably since we began. In the 70s, when I started, you did everything at 132. You would normally call your patter at 130 to 132, and the sing calls went 132. People can't move and don't really want to move that quickly anymore. Plus, the complexity of our choreography is such that you just can't move your feet that fast and stay with what's going on. So today, we have gotten down to the 128, and now I find that for singing calls, I'm doing them at 126. And patter about 124.
Hmm.
Because that's the speed. Now, the East Coast, where you guys are, you move faster than you do on the West Coast. So if I go East Coast, I'm going to call in Atlanta or Washington or New York, whatever, I'm going to probably run about 128 and then maybe patter 126. I go to California, I'm going to go 124, 126. Just depends on where you are.
Wow, that's very specific and not something I mostly call up and down the Mid-Atlantic and the Eastern Seaboard, and it's not something that I've had experience with the difference. That's fascinating.
Well, I think what you'll find is if you do experiment with that, is that if you find the right tempo, you hit a comfort level of that floor. And your age group will make a difference. The type of music you do makes a difference. There's no such thing as standard, at least not in my opinion. For example, if you're going to call a song that's what I call a shuffle rhythm, I don't know if you're familiar with a tune called Scotch and Soda, for example. It's a tune. If you're going to call that type of rhythm, you can call it faster than you can with a tune, because the feel makes it feel like you're going faster than with that shuffle rhythm. So you just, you know, you hit a comfort zone, and once you do, it's a thing called the emotional control. If you get emotional control over your floor, they'll dance anything you want to call.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But if you fight them, they're going to win every time.
Yep. This concludes the first half of our interview with Wade. Tune in next week for the conclusion. A big thanks to Wade Driver for joining us this morning. What a great history and what a great career he's had.
Yeah, whoever knew that he was a Navy? What a way to start your full-time square dance calling career, huh?
Yep.
And that master's in audio engineering. That sounds like something that maybe if you're going to be a record producer, you'd want to have, but he didn't even know at the time. So
yeah, I was very surprised. Very surprised to hear that.
Yeah.
And to have it in your family. I mean, to have your dad, you know, have it as his avocation, and to be able to learn. And apparently, his dad was quite strict, but by the same token, picked everything up and learned very well.
Yeah.
I did think that having three pages of notes felt a little excessive.
For your first try.
Right.
Well, it's either perfect or it's wrong. Maybe that should be my motto. I don't know.
There you go.
I would not be allowed to square dance anymore if I had to be perfect, though. I know that.
What do you have coming up this weekend, Barb?
Dale, can you believe I have a plan-free weekend?
I don't
have anything written.
Not just square dance-free, but a plan-free weekend.
There's nothing written down. I'm a little nervous. I don't know what that means.
Perhaps you've forgotten something. Your close relative has a wedding and on the other side of the continent, and you just haven't made it there. You know,
good grief. I hope my calendar is better than that. What about you? You probably have something more exciting than plan-free.
Well, I do have to tell you, having a plan-free weekend sounds very appealing.
Sometimes, yeah, you need the downtime, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, I have the opposite. I've got a weekend of calling up and down the Mid-Atlantic, the Eastern Seaboard. I'm calling in Delaware on Friday night. I have a Saturday night dance that got canceled, so I'm going to be staying with friends, and he's actually having a birthday party for himself, inviting friends over to play games.
Oh, good.
And then I get up very early on Sunday morning and drive to Katona, New York, and call for a club. And then that evening, I drive back to New Jersey and call for a club called the Motivators. Drive home on Sunday evening to get up bright and early and go to work on Monday morning.
Whoa, that sounds like a lot of busy.
It is a lot of busy, but it's also a lot of fun. I know all of these groups, and they're very lively, very fun. And the gaming, the board gaming that we do on Saturday will no doubt be a great deal of fun.
I know you'd like that. Very good.
I do very much.
Great.
Well, thanks to our guest, Wade Driver.
This is Barb Jarvis from Wheeling, Illinois. Goodbye, Dale. Have a good week, everyone.
And this is Dale Hodge from Columbia, Maryland. See you, Barb. Happy dancing. See you on the dance floor. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.